Hey, folks, thanks for tuning in to another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Before we get to the fun, here's a quick word from one of our sponsors.
It goes back to like before I was ready to get a divorce. It's been like 10 or more years. Waking up like several times a night and not being able to get back to sleep.
That's Mitch, a sleep cocktail customer in Santa Cruz, California.
I get 2 hours of good sleep. And then after that, my eyes would open and toss and turn, and the rest of the night was really not restful at all.
Then Mitch found out about Sleep Cocktail and started sleeping through the night, every night.
So nice to be getting rest again after, you know, all those years of not. And even if I do wake up in the middle of the night, I'm able to get back to sleep.
Do you have trouble falling asleep or staying asleep? Try Doc Parsley's Sleep Cocktail. Go to robwolf.com/sleepcocktail and use code ROBWOLF10 to save 10%.
Hi, folks. Rob Wolf here with another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Very excited for today's guest. Dawn Kernagis is a research scientist in the area of human performance optimization. She does a lot of work with Naval Special Warfare and some DARPA-funded research looking at the extreme environments that our operators exist in as part of their day-to-day work. Dawn, how are you doing?
Great. How are you doing today, Rob?
Really good. It's sunny and warm and nice in Reno, so I absolutely can't complain.
Well, it's the same here in Pensacola. So
shocker. Yeah. Shocker. Well, Dawn, give folks a bit of your history and scientific background.
So actually, I got into research kind of from a little bit of a backwards path. So I started off actually as a professional diver. So when I was in high school, actually even before I was in high school, I became interested in scuba diving, and I was always interested in science. I was always the geek carrying around the big heavy books, which is probably why I have a bad back to this day. but I would carry around big books. I studied fossils. I studied the oceans. I would read Jacques Cousteau's books, like, you know, from front to cover all the time, front to back all the time. And I just was a total geek growing up. So I decided I wanted to learn how to scuba dive. I actually wanted to be a marine biologist. I figured that out at 9, you know, because you know where you're going at 9 years old. So I learned how to scuba dive and just literally fell in love with it, just completely, so to speak, immersed myself into the sport of scuba diving. Started working at dive shops when I was in high school. And actually started working on cave diving projects when I was in high school as well. So instead of going to prom, I was actually cave diving in the Springs of North Florida.
Nice.
So, and I don't have any regrets over that. But so I started working on larger scale projects as I gained experience. And over the years, I got the chance to travel all over the place, to Mexico and France and Germany. And one of the big projects I worked with over the years from about 1996 to 2007 was a project called the Woodville Karst Plain Project. And it's a deep underwater cave exploration project that's focused around the springs just south of Tallahassee, Florida. So while I was in college, I was driving down on weekends probably a couple times a month to either dive or also I was a dive manager on the project. So I would oversee all the different team operations, all the people going in and out of the water, upwards of several dozen divers doing pretty extreme dives, stuff that's not, you know, in a standard recreational diving format. So, you know, dives that were 300 feet in depth, typically on average, maybe just a little bit less than that, for hours bottom time, which meant a lot of decompression to minimize risk of getting the bends and a lot of different gas mixes. And so you kind of just get thrown into this environment, and I loved every bit of it. But there's this part of me that, you know, over the years while I was doing all this, there's this part of me that wanted to do something bigger and have a bigger impact, both on the diving community, but just kind of in general as well. So I started asking some questions. I had some ideas of research that I wanted to go after, and who turned out to be my advisor in school, Dr. Richard Moon. I went to him. I wasn't even working at Duke at the time, but he's at Duke University. And I went to him with some ideas and said, "Hey, I've got some research ideas. How do we do this? Can we do this?" And he was like, "Yeah, I think it's a great idea." So my idea was to look for potential biomarkers of decompression stress in divers. Up to that point, there wasn't anything out there. and or at least as far as objective biomarkers went. And so he's like, I think it's a great idea, but we're going to need money to do that. So I was like, well, how do we get money? So he said, well, we've got to write a grant. So he kind of walked me through the process. So I ended up writing a proposal to the Office of Naval Research, and it got funded. So then I turned that into my PhD project. I went to ONR and I said, well, you know, can I do this as my graduate research? They said, well, we've never funded anybody as a pre-doctoral student, but I think you could be a good candidate. We'll see how this works. No pressure. And so we ended up going after it. And then I went to Duke and I said, hey, I've got funding. Will you take me as a grad student? And they said, well, yeah, of course. I always laugh that if I hadn't had funding, I'm not sure if they would have accepted me. But they welcomed me with open arms. But yeah, so it just started off there and then just transitioned into the work that I did as a grad student and then transitioned into the work I did as a postdoc. And now here at the Institute for Human and Machine Cognition.
And you, like we were saying, you had to hang out with Dominic DiAgostino occasionally, and then Dr. Ken Ford, who's one of my favorite people in the world. So I'm I'm incredibly jealous. And you go diving all the time. I love spearfishing, so I'm incredibly jealous. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's you know, I haven't had a chance to dive as much since I've been here, just because it's that transition period into, you know, what's equivalent of a new faculty position. But the opportunities are abound, and you know, the Gulf Coast is absolutely an amazing place to go diving. And yeah, Dom is actually the reason that I met Ken Ford in the first place. So Dom was a postdoc while I was a pre-doc with Office of Naval Research, and so he told Ken about me, and Ken and I met, and it just, you know, transitioned from there.
That's fantastic.
Yeah,
Don, tell folks a little bit if they're not familiar with what the challenges are of the hyperbaric environment. Like what happens with, you know, kind of respiration and blood gases, nitrogen at normal atmospheric pressure. And then what happens as we start getting into these hyperbaric environments?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, one thing, you're talking about nitrogen. So I'm not sure how many of your listeners are divers themselves, but there's a condition that you can experience called nitrogen narcosis. Essentially, is breathing higher partial pressures of nitrogen. So as you go deeper, specifically when you breathe air, the high partial pressure of nitrogen is going to lead to what they call the Martini effect, Martini's law. So essentially, as you go deeper, the drunker that you feel and the less cognitively focused you are. So, or at least your cognition is becomes more and more limited, and you start to have issues with, you know, focusing and task management, and it gets worse as you go deeper. So that's one thing.
Don, what mechanistically causes that? Like, is the nitrogen actually displacing oxygen? Is it altering some, like, glucose receptor sites? Like, what exactly is happening in that process?
It's a great question. So we don't know all the specifics. And Dominic DiAgostino has actually done a little bit of research in this area, but they think it has to do with lipid solubility and the properties of the nitrogen, but they don't know all the specifics right now. So what we do right now, what the community does, is they incorporate helium into the breathing mix. So helium has a much lower narcotic effect than essentially a nil narcotic effect compared to nitrogen. And so divers are able to perform with, you know, better task loading and have a better cognitive performance with helium replacing that nitrogen in the gas mix.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And so then you have oxygen toxicity, which can take the form. So what's interesting is we think, oh, oxygen's a great thing, but too much oxygen is actually a bad thing. So you can have two different types of oxygen toxicity. One is pulmonary oxygen toxicity, and it tends to be when you breathe higher pressures of oxygen for longer periods of time. So I was talking about the divers that we worked with in the cave systems in Florida. Those divers would breathe large amounts of oxygen during their decompression, both during the dive, but also during the decompression. So as they're coming up from their dive, they're breathing higher and higher partial pressures of oxygen as they come up slowly but surely. And that helps to get rid of that inert gas that's in the blood and tissues and kind of creates that pressure differential. The problem is that the lungs actually get kind of beat up from that, and they think it has to do with oxidative stress, mm-hmm. Inflammation. And so you get kind of like a cough and, you know, kind of raspy breathing, and you have reduced pulmonary capacity. So that's pulmonary oxygen toxicity. Now, then there's also central nervous system oxygen toxicity. And this is a lot of the work that Dom's been doing with the ketogenic diet and ketone ester administration has been looking at CNS oxygen toxicity. And this is where divers, when they breathe extremely high partial pressures of oxygen. So if you breathe 100% oxygen at, you know, 2 atmospheres, so essentially at 30 feet or even deeper, you have this increased risk of developing underwater seizures underwater. So they're grand mal style seizures. And obviously that is not ideal underwater. There's a high risk of drowning with that. And so, so those are two major considerations. So you would say, well, okay, you can minimize the risk of something like nitrogen narcosis and then also decompression sickness, which I'll talk about in a second, by just eliminating all the inert gas, or, you know, just trying to minimize the amount of inert gas in your breathing gas. The problem with that is then you increase your risk for oxygen toxicity, which can be very deadly.
So this is some of the, I imagine there's, I've never done much scuba diving. I mainly do free diving. So this stuff is pretty new to me, but I would assume there's kind of some charts and rubrics, like if you're going to be at this depth for this duration, then we would probably recommend this air mixture so that we're minimizing oxygen toxicity versus nitrogen narcosis and whatnot. I assume that stuff is fairly well fleshed out.
Yeah, so you know, for the recreational diver, for the standard person who's you know, getting certified to scuba dive, typically there are three types of gases that they breathe. So either air, which is pretty straightforward, you know, just compressed air, and then they have two different types of what they call nitrox. So essentially, it's like air, but it has an increased percentage of oxygen. So either 32% or 36% oxygen in the gas mix, and the rest is nitrogen. So it just helps minimize that inert gas uptake, that nitrogen uptake, so it makes the dive safer with respect to the risk of decompression sickness. Mm-hmm. But then you also have depth limits with those gases because you do have a higher partial pressure of oxygen in them. So you don't want to have that risk of CNS oxygen toxicity. So with respect to some of the more advanced diving, so either the technical diving, the deep diving, or even military diving, they have different gas mixes that they use that's highly dependent on the mission, the depth, the duration. So you know, different levels of helium in the mix, different levels of oxygen in the mix. It's fleshed out, but you know, there's still a lot of you know, back and forth with respect to what the optimal mixes are for a lot of these different missions.
Right. And then you have a further wrinkle in this whole story with rebreathers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So rebreather technology is essentially, incredible. So for a recreational diver, it's great because, so just going back, a rebreather essentially scrubs out the carbon dioxide that you exhale and helps kind of recycle the gas that you're breathing, which is great. It's a closed loop system. It's helps save the gas supply that you have. So essentially your gas supply that you have typically will last you longer because you are kind of recycling the gas that you're breathing. But there are risks involved with that as well, because it is a closed loop system. It is a little more complicated than a typical, you know, just basic open circuit, what we call open circuit system. So just a basic scuba setup. And the military tends to use these rebreathers a lot. The technical diving community uses them a lot. A lot of that's because of, you know, just for safety factors, for building in that redundancy and that that, you know, extended gas supply.
Mm-hmm. And part of that is because even though we with each breath that we take, we remove a certain percentage of the oxygen out of that breath. But then when we exhale, unless we just like hold our breath for 2 minutes or something, we still have a significant amount of oxygen that's still left. We're putting out a decent amount of oxygen, but also some carbon dioxide. And then these rebreathers pull the carbon dioxide out of that mix.
Yep, exactly.
Fantastic. So where are you looking at for, I noticed in some of your graduate work that you were actually looking at some genetic considerations of tendency towards developing the bends, the nitrogen problems with coming up from depth too rapidly. I've talked with Dr. Kirk Parsley, who's a former SEAL. Now he's a physician, and he's one of these people that he literally has never been sick. He cannot get a hangover. and he appeared to be immune from the bends. Like he just never had any symptoms with it. Did some rather knuckle-headed go down deep, come back fast, no problem. So are there some genetic differences there? And if there are, what's kind of driving those differences?
Yeah, that's a great question. So actually, funny enough, so another round of connections that you and I have. So I actually met Dr. Parsley way back in the day, before I ever started graduate school. We met at an undersea medicine conference in Hawaii through mutual friends. And actually, we were talking about getting him here to IHMC to talk about his sleep research. So his name came back up in another conversation with Peter Attia, actually. And yeah, so I laughed because it's a very small community right. when it comes to human performance optimization. But Kirk's a great guy and he's doing some incredible work. So yeah, it's cool to hear his name. But yeah, so as far as, predisposition or immunity, if you want to call it that, to decompression sickness, that's a great question. And so the work that I did kind of starting off when I was looking at genes and how they're expressed in response to decompression stress. So I actually didn't cover decompression stress and the different risks, but essentially decompression stress, you have this inert gas uptake in your blood and tissues as you descend and as you dive while you're during the bottom phase of your dive. And as you come back up, if you reach a point where the partial pressure of the gases in the blood and tissue, the inert gas, is larger than the surrounding pressure, you can have bubble formation. And bubble formation could potentially lead to the development of what we call decompression sickness. So it's just a heterogeneous syndrome where anywhere from quote unquote pain only, which I think if you're the person receiving that pain, you're not thinking it's pain only, but all the way up to CNS decompression sickness, pulmonary decompression sickness, and pretty severe forms of decompression sickness. So what's interesting about it is, so you think, oh, well, if you just measure all the bubbles and count the bubbles and when you're doing these dives, so there are different ways that we can measure bubbles in the blood and tissues. So one is listening for them through using Doppler ultrasound. And the other way is using transthoracic echocardiogram. And so essentially you're looking at bubbles that are passing through the vasculature. And you can actually see, like in some dives, that people have so many bubbles. When you're looking at the heart, as the bubbles pass through, it's actually whiting out the image of the heart wall. There's so many bubbles.
Wow.
So what's interesting about this is, I had the chance to do field studies, and all my graduate student cohorts would laugh at me. They're like, "You got such a tough job. You have to go to Grand Cayman to go study deep divers." But we would follow these guys that were doing, and girls who were doing pretty extreme diving exposures, just like the ones that I talked about in the projects that I had worked with earlier. And they were doing it by choice, so it wasn't anything that an IRB would ever let you get away with in a research setting. But for us, we were able to, just kind of watch and observe these divers and do the transthoracic echo to see how many bubbles they're coming up with. And what was interesting is there are some individuals that didn't bubble a lot, typically kind of on a regular basis, but there are some individuals who bubbled a ton every day and they never showed symptoms.
Hmm.
They never had... they weren't lethargic. They, at least not that they told us, right? So, right. I think we had one hit over the course of, we had one case of decompression sickness over the course of several years of me going down there, which is pretty impressive considering we were covered. We followed, about a dozen plus divers every year. And these are divers, a lot of them were bubbling severely on a daily basis and just no symptoms. So it's really interesting. So there's a discrepancy between, detectable bubbles. So, and I will emphasize that because maybe there are bubbles out there that we're just not seeing, and those could be causing symptoms somewhere. But there's a discrepancy between detectable bubbles and actual development of decompression sickness. So going back to my graduate work, I said, well, what if we look for an objective biomarker? There's no objective biomarker of like the pathophysiological stress that's being incurred by the body in response to these bubbles being around. And so at first I had this list of like 40 something markers I wanted to look at based off of complement activation and coagulation and inflammation. And then I took a step back and I was talking with one of the professors at Duke, and he said, there's this new technology called gene expression microarray technology. And essentially from a single sample, you can look at thousands or tens of thousands of transcripts. So essentially the signal, the signal from a gene that's being expressed. So you have DNA to RNA to protein. So essentially you're looking at the RNA message that's coming from that gene. So the gene's either being turned on or off in response to a certain stress, and you're able to kind of look at these changes between pre-dive versus post-dive. So what I proposed was to look at gene expression microarray, use that technology, and blood samples that were collected before a dive. So it's just getting an individual's baseline before they go in for a dive, and then after a dive. I would have loved to have gotten a timeline of these, you know, changes in gene expression, but, you know, funding is relatively limited, so we had to be smart about it. So we picked a 2-hour post-dive time point because that's typically just after when you would see peak bubble formation. Hmm. So we did pre versus post, and we looked at over 14,000 transcripts, so over about 14,000 genes that we were able to measure simultaneously from a single sample, and compared those genes pre versus post-dive in each individual. And what was interesting is, you know, it was peripheral blood samples. So, I mean, a lot of the things that we found that were activated were things that you kind of would expect given that you're looking at, you know, peripheral blood cells. So we found immune response. We found oxidative stress response. We found complement activation related genes. But there seemed to be this kind of consistent signature that was related to what we term as decompression stress. So the idea from there is to go forward in future studies and say, okay, so these are some of the key genes that seem to be activated in response, or even downregulated in response to decompression stress. Is there a difference in individuals with respect to how those genes are regulated? And are those genes related to predisposition to decompression sickness, or even, as you said, resilience to decompression sickness? So it's kind of a starting point that we had, at least to kind of get some of the gene candidates that we want to look at down the line. What's also interesting is there are studies that were done in other settings looking at peripheral blood mononuclear cells, and that so settings that are kind of similar to decompression stress, what we would think of as what's causing decompression stress, and that includes cardiopulmonary bypass. And so what's interesting is a lot of the genes that they found, and some of these studies were actually conducted at Duke University before I started my studies, some of the genes that were found to correlate with a person's increased risk of, you know, a poor outcome after cardiopulmonary bypass were actually some of the same genes that we found in our study, as far as those that were activated kind of significantly in certain individuals after diving.
Interesting. Is there any similarity between that decompression process and the inflammation and whatnot and ischemic reperfusion injury?
Yes, that's okay. A great question. Yeah, absolutely. Especially depending on, you know, if you have a bubble that gets trapped essentially in a vessel and then, you know, it's released, you do have this ischemia reperfusion injury. And that's it's a great question. Yeah.
So you could have, like, maybe even independent of the ischemia from perhaps a large bubble, you've got just some oxidative stress and some general damage, and then you actually do potentially get the ischemic reperfusion injury, which is a big deal in like tissue transplants and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. It was really interesting going through the literature, and even things like when I was in grad school, one of my good friends does research in the area of radiation induced injury, and a lot of the same genes and a lot of the same pathways that we were seeing in our studies were popping up in their studies. So it's oxidative stress response, it's inflammation, it's, you know, all the things that you would think of. So there just seems to be this overlapping theme of, you know, kind of oxidative stress trying to minimize inflammation. So
right. And it's interesting to me that like the ketogenic diet is being studied both for hyperbaric oxygen stress as well as hypobaric, like both a high altitude and you know, arguably multiple atmospheres of pressure and very different environments, but both of those creating some substrate utilization challenges and then also oxidative stress, and the ketone esters might be a really powerful tool for all that.
Yeah, absolutely. And going back to what I was just talking about with the radiation, same thing. Mm-hmm. They're looking at it for protection against radiation and induced injury, both in the brain and also globally. So it's kind of these underlying pathways that, you know, our body has in place to essentially kind of protect us against injury. But it seems to be kind of this consistent theme of oxidative stress and inflammation, kind of global inflammation that we're trying to reduce. So
interesting. Yeah. So now you're before we started recording, you said that your specific area of research isn't as much in the ketogenic diet realm, but how much are you fiddling that with the folks that you're working with? I'm still trying to figure out what good general population recommendations are around the ketogenic diet. Like I tend to work with a lot of MMA athletes and these really glycolytically based athletes. And I've had a heck of a time making a more ketogenic type diet work in those folks. Like using some MCT oil has helped because we can still keep some carbs in the mix and whatnot. But do you have any thoughts on like kind of general population application with some of the research that you're doing and then also potentially the ketogenic diet for folks?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question as well. So for the research that we're doing, a lot of the applications we're looking at, this goes back to my area of research specifically, is operators in extreme environments. Mm-hmm. So, like you were talking about, people who are going to hypobaric environments or hypoxic environments, like high altitude operators, high altitude aviators, we're looking at it and with respect to the diving population. So Dom's work with CNS oxygen toxicity and Navy divers. We're looking at it, or at least I would say we. It's more Dom that's doing this work, not me.
Right.
But we have these arms. So what's interesting is, so my research is more focused on the molecular level changes that are occurring. And so we have a lot of these studies that we're proposing to include a ketogenic diet or a ketone ester supplement arm to the studies to look at, are these individuals even further protected in these extreme environments? And again, it's because you have this kind of same theme that's going on of oxidative stress environment, essentially. The other interesting one is the astronaut population. Mm-hmm. So, given that Scott Kelly actually just got back,
right.
Got back to Earth. So that's another really interesting one because of, there are a number of different factors that they're facing, including potential radiation-induced CNS injury and, just kind of a global oxidative stress environment. That's another population that we're looking at. As far as the general population, one of the things that we've talked about looking at is looking at genetic factors related to ketogenic diet response. So, are some people just genetically, do they respond better because of some kind of basis of genetics to a ketogenic diet or ketone ester supplementation compared to others? So that's an area that we're getting ready to get into, just kind of with the general population, or we've talked about at least with the general population. So, and I don't want to speak for Dom because that is his area, that is his area of research. But I think that there's a lot of interesting questions to be answered. And honestly, if you're talking about global inflammation, that's, you're talking about all of us on a daily basis,
right?
Just based off of the stresses that we put ourselves through, some of the basic exposure, just psychological stress, diet, just general exercise, exposure to just kind of the daily living, essentially. So I think that there's definitely a lot of applications there. And one of the big questions is, how are people responding and how can you optimize that within the general population?
Right.
I think it's, yeah.
Right. This is possibly totally out in left field, but did you see any significant GI problems from folks that were maybe more prone to decompression problems? I'm fishing and asking somewhat of a leading question, but did you have any sense that these folks had increased levels of like GI distress or irritable bowel syndrome or anything like that?
Not that I know of, but mm-hmm. That's a really interesting question. Are you, and I'm kind of curious, are you getting to like gut microbiome? Is that where you're leading with that?
I'm wondering, gut microbiome and potentially also just, if we see, changes in the intestinal permeability, LPS translocating into the circulation just with a missed night of sleep or with really vigorous exercise and stuff like that. And so I'm just wondering if this would fall within that spectrum of being kind of a potential GI irritant, and yet again, maybe some sort of a ketone intervention or like a anti-inflammatory diet intervention could be helpful with that. I've worked with Naval Special Warfare for about 6 years, and it was interesting when I first started kind of peppering in this paleo diet idea. Like the guys had already been playing with it, and they reported a lot of different benefits. They just seemed to bounce back from training more effectively, and particularly guys that were getting up there a little bit older, which older in SEAL population is like post 30. These guys take a lot of abuse, but it was interesting to me, and a lot of them reported that they saw improved digestion, like they had gas and bloating and maybe some GERD and whatnot previously, and then they would eat kind of a paleo anti-inflammatory diet, not even necessarily ketogenic, and they would report some improvements. And I'm just wondering if that's potentially another angle that could be investigated, trying to have as little of a immunogenic load or a gut irritating load. Like if the gut is already kind of under assault, is that another factor that could exacerbate the overall system? And it's complete guess. I know nothing about any of this, but just throwing it against the wall.
No, I think it's a really interesting question. And yeah, we'll have to put in a proposal and get you involved in that.
I'll help write the grant. That sounds super, super interesting. Some people are well known for abs. I'm known for poo. So that's my area of expertise is poo. So that's interesting. What are your thoughts? Have you played around at all yourself with a ketogenic diet as part of your diving?
I have not. So what's interesting, so I have friends who are very interested in it, and I pointed them in the direction of talking to Dom, actually, especially some of the divers that are still involved in these projects that I talked about that I've since retired from, but some of the deep divers who are undergoing extreme loads with respect to inert gas, but also exposure to high partial pressures of oxygen. And so one of the big concerns that they all have is, how do I reduce my inflammation? How do I kind of protect myself against the assault from these dives? And so a lot of them have been turning towards ketogenic diet. I have not been doing that kind of diving in the last, since I started grad school, essentially. It's one of those things that, unless you're doing it all the time, it's not a very safe thing to do.
Right.
But if I were doing that kind of diving again, I would definitely start dabbling in that direction more. And I played around with it a little bit. I mean, obviously being here at IHMC and with Ken Ford, we get exposed to all kinds of amazing ketogenic food. So, we are spoiled rotten, and even Ken's ketogenic ice cream and IHMC ketogenic ice cream, and also Dom. Dom and I kind of do this kind of tag team presentation. We've worked with a couple of different groups where he and I both present, so we end up going to a lot of the same meetings. And so I play around with it, just spending more time around these guys. But if I were really putting myself out there doing those kind of dives, I would definitely be looking in that direction. So
interesting. Yeah. I continue to fiddle with it. Like I eat on the lower carb side of things. I use some MCT oils. I unfortunately fell in love with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which is a very glycolytic based sport. And I've really tried to crack that nut, and Ken has just leaned on me mercilessly. He's like, you just got to stick with it. And like, I've done it for 6-7 months, and I'm just kind of missing this low gear. And I'm, I already get the tar beat out of me at jiu-jitsu. And so dropping another 10 or 15% off of my performance, just more than my ego can handle. But I keep fiddling at that lower end of things. And I definitely seem to do better. And I just did some genetic testing through 23andMe.
Okay, good.
Both of my parents developed type 2 diabetes early in life, poor diets, alcohol, that sort of stuff. But it was interesting that I, according to the 23andMe findings, I'm about 300% more likely to develop type 2 diabetes than the standard population. And I definitely am the doughy Northern European guy if my carbohydrate intake starts creeping up too much. So there's something to that for me. So I continue to fiddle around with all that.
Yeah, I've got the same genetic makeup. It's kind of this combination Norwegian, Lithuanian, you know. So yeah, I head in that direction. But so yeah, lower carb and, you know, just kind of, I mean, I know ketogenic diet is not lower carb, so that's not the basis of it. But, you know, just trying to pay more attention to my food intake. And I will say that being here at IHMC is definitely transition that kind of mindset significantly compared to when I was at Duke. So,
man, there's nowhere to hide there. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. Well, Don, what's your next area of exploration that you're working on?
So we have a couple of different cool projects, some that are out as far as proposals go and some that have been approved and are moving forward. So one thing that we're doing is actually, this just got funded, is a knowledge-based model of undersea medicine. So at IHMC, they've developed this tool called concept mapping. And actually some of the world's leading experts in concept mapping are here at IHMC, and actually are founders of IHMC. So essentially it's just kind of organizing the knowledge for the undersea medicine community and kind of putting it in a format that's tangible for on the user end of things. So either that's a program manager from the Office of Naval Research, or it could be a diver themselves, or it could be, you know, someone who wants to get into research and say, what kind of research has been done up to this point and how does everything connect? So that's one project that we just got funded from ONR, and we're really excited about moving forward with that. Some other studies that we have that are out there right now that have been proposed, and that several of them are slowly but surely moving forward, is looking at epigenetics. So looking at changes to how our genes are expressed, and potentially permanent changes or even heritable changes in response to different diving exposures or even extreme environmental exposures. So has not been looked at in our area yet, in our field, but I can only imagine with the stresses that we experience and the oxidative stress and the inflammation, everything that we've been talking about, that you are going to see some types of epigenetic changes that occur in these populations. So in extreme diving populations, we're looking at potentially saturation divers. We're looking at potentially looking at a submarine population. So, you know, all of this is just, you know, highly dependent on whether or not the funding kicks in. But that's kind of the next area. And then another area of interest that we're putting forth is looking at the glymphatic system. So looking at the brain glymphatic system and how that's affected with extreme environmental exposures. So we've got a couple of questions there with respect to both diving and immersion and then also space and microgravity. So we're going to kind of push all of that forward.
Oh, fascinating stuff. Wow, that's amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
Don, where can folks track you down on the interwebs or find out more about your work?
Yeah, you can find my page at on IHMC's website. So just Google Don Kernegas IHMC, and there's a link to my site, and actually contact information is there as well. So if anybody has any questions or thoughts or ideas, please feel free to reach out to me.
Fantastic. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Don, it was really fun having you on the show. Theoretically, I'm going to be out your direction in October, I think.
Awesome.
October this year. Yeah, I think so. Ken invited me out there. Clearly, the standards at IHMC have plummeted dramatically if they're going to have me go out there and do a talk. So I'll do my best to represent. I started looking at some of the list of presenters and I'm like, oh my God, I am terrified to go get in that scene, but I'll do the best job I can.
No, we're excited to have you out here, and you know, you'll be treated to the best ketogenic food. I can promise you that.
Fantastic. So, I love it. I love it. Well, Don, thank you again so much for coming on the show, and I look forward to meeting all of you guys in person here soon.
You too. Thank you so much, Rob. I appreciate it.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.